Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Hey, everybody. I'm so pumped because I spent the weekend partially at the pool, actually, reading Andre Henry's newest book, All the White Friends I Couldn't Keep, Hope and Hard Pills to Swallow About Fighting for Black Lives. And we finally got our audio together. So, hey, Andre, I think everyone can hear both of us now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so pumped to have you. I want to say a couple of things that I'm going to link before we get going on the conversation on the book. And that is, first, that I just watched your Playing Hooky video on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to link that because I think it's phenomenal. And I first heard of you and your work and some of the stuff actually that you write about in the book, like the boulder and things like that, on a conversation you had with Dr. Labberton, who is the current president mm-hmm. of Fuller Seminary. And so I'm going to link that conversation as well, because that one was really impactful for me as a listener when I heard that. So I realize there may be a little bit of overlap in the content, but I would be really excited mm-hmm. for people to go and hear you on Dr. Labberton's podcast as well. So I just want to throw that out there. So first, I just want to say that I love the way that you have presented us with a few threads in this book that kind of go the whole way through. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it reads like a memoir, but there's enough of your story in it to make it feel really, really personal in that way. Right. I mean, there's enough of your story in it. And there's also enough of your vision as an artist, as an activist, your vision for the future. And I have to say, I was super intrigued, not just by the title, we'll get there, but by Jamar Tisby's endorsement, because he calls the book militant. That's the first thing he says. And so I want to go there with you, because that's one of the things kind of throughout the book. You talk about this movement being nonviolent and militant, as opposed to militaristic.
Right.
And that there's a difference. So I don't really know where you want to start, but I just love that there's this vision, there's artistic creativity and your own story going through it to talk about this nonviolent but militant movement that you're seeking to be a part of and build.
Yeah. Well, you know, the militant part is important to me because, first off, I learned it from, you know, Dr. King was actually the first person that I heard talk about, you know, militant nonviolence. And this was something that, because only get so much of Dr. King, you know, in school, and mostly it's a kind of whitewashed version of him, right? We don't hear a lot of what his perspective is in his own words, right? But I spent a lot of time in Dr. King's writings and speeches. And he uses a lot of militant language, including the word itself. You know, he says, you know, the 1867, the year before he passed, he talked about, you know, nonviolence being militantly organized, being still the best hope that, you know, Black people have for liberation. So I'm careful to include that because when we talk about nonviolent struggle, civil resistance, which people shorten to nonviolence a lot, you know, there are all of these ideas that are flying around. And some of them, I think, are costly misconceptions about what it actually means to engage in nonviolent struggle against oppression. And one of those biggest misconceptions, first off, is that a lot of people don't understand that it is an active method of struggle, right? And if you understand that it is an active method of struggle, then you can understand a little bit more why the militant part makes sense, because We're talking about militant in the sense that it is strategic, it is active, it's confrontational, you know, it depends on a deep analysis of the conflict situation. And all of these things are really how conflict is waged, you know. So just one more thing I want to say about that is a lot of people, I think, are shy about that kind of language because we do live in a world of perpetual war. And so I think some people, you know, they get nervous about that. But what I said in the book about being Black in an anti-Black world is that you may not like to think about this in those terms, but if you're Black in this anti-Black world, the world is already at war with you. They're already at war with you. And when you go out to protest, they're going to come out with tanks and guns and flash bang grenades and tear gas and all those things, right? And so you have to understand that the way that they operate in this militaristic society, I'm calling them the powers because we're, you know, you're a theology student, so you understand probably Walter Wink's, you know, theology, how he refers to these things as the powers. I stole that language from him, you know, but that the powers that be are literally, they engage in warfare against the oppressed. And so in a way, we have no choice but to respond in a somewhat militant way, right? But without weapons, which is what many practitioners of nonviolence call nonviolent struggle. They call it war without weapons. Because in many ways, you do engage in some of the same types of behaviors, which is the analysis, the confrontation, the strategy, you know, the organizing of people, all that kind of thing.
Yeah, but it's important that you talk about it that way and talk about it being active. Because even in the video that I just watched, this is where it gets misconstrued inside of whiteness, inside of white evangelicalism, inside of some of these schools of thought and communities of people, where instead of being seen as active and strategic and fighting a war without weapons, it is seen as it should, they're saying it should be instead, or in their minds, it's passive. Nonviolence means passive.
Yes.
Nonviolence means rolling over or being a doormat or not responding at all, right?
When you really dig down into what people are talking about when they bring up nonviolence, eventually you get to the point where they realize they're talking about doing nothing. They're talking about inaction altogether.
Right, which is not the point and doesn't bring about change and all of this.
Right, exactly.
Right. But I do find it interesting. There was something I was thinking about as I was prepping for our time together this morning, because like I said, the book follows a lot of your story, and you're the son of a Jamaican immigrant, grew up in Stone Mountain, Georgia, which I feel like that we could just talk about that for like a while. But you, the way that you describe your upbringing, going to college, going to seminary, all of this, like, I want to say, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Maybe I should just ask you to describe it. But kind of what I jotted down was you were like submerged or surrounded by whiteness, right? And to the point that it impacted how you saw yourself, how you saw your family, how you interacted with the world, right? And so the title of this book, The White Friends That You Couldn't Keep, I was thinking about some situations that my husband and I have been in where I start to kind of fuss, you know, about this community or this situation or something. And he reminds me, Lex, we're the ones who changed. They've always been this way. Yeah. We just couldn't see it because we were a part of it too, right? And I felt that in your book, like these friends, these adoptive families, right? These people who you were in close knit community with, when your apocalypse, as you term it, started to happen, when the unveiling started to happen for you, and you started to recognize the whiteness in the world, the anti-Blackness in the world, these relationships became strained, but it wasn't necessarily because they had changed. They were the way they had always been, perhaps, but it was your perspective that was changing, and it was you who was growing. So yeah. Can you give us an example or something that might illustrate maybe before your apocalypse, like on Andre and Stone Mountain, or something like before your apocalypse started to happen, the unveiling started to happen in your life?
Yeah, you know, I talk about this in the book, but I don't use this example, but this is the one that comes to mind. There was years ago, I think it was 2015 or something like that. I think it was 2012, because I was still in New York. And then I can't remember his name, but from Duck Dynasty.
Oh, Phil Robertson.
Yes, Phil Robertson. So
yes,
they did an interview with him for GQ. I remember now. It's 2013. 2013 they interviewed him for GQ, and Phil Robertson, I can't remember how they get on these subjects, you know, because somehow they get on, LGBTQ issues, and they get on race. And he said something about Black people being happy when he was growing up. You know, he never once saw a Black person mistreated, and, you know, they were always singing and they were always happy. Now, at the time, I didn't know what I know now about American history. And I remember people being upset, and I didn't understand why they were upset about what he had said, because I thought, well, maybe that's really his experience. Maybe he really didn't ever see any Black people upset or, you know, mistreated, or and maybe where he lived, Black people seem happy. Now, knowing what I know now, I know that first off, most white people don't even have Black friends. They don't have deep connections with Black people. So most white people are not, you know, connected. And then by the time I wrote the book, this memory came back to me. I mentioned it in the book, in The Right to Be Angry, because when I was writing that chapter, I this memory came up of me, not trying to defend him, but just trying to be balanced. Because there was a time when I always wanted to just take what people said on its own terms and examine it on their own terms and take it in good faith and try to find some kind of middle ground, you know. A part of what I'm doing is trying to decide how thick is my accent going to be today, if I'm going to say miggle or middle, if people still understand me, if me say miggle. So anyway, I try to find some kind of middle ground, right? And so anyway, when I'm writing it in the book years later, I'm like, wait a minute, this man says that when he was growing up, that he could tell that Black people were angry. In the middle of Jim Crow, because a man born in 1945, right? He's born in 1945, and he wants to say that he can't tell that Black people were angry. And then add to that the list that white people have been trying to say that Black people were happy and content underneath our oppression since emancipation, since just before emancipation. Once emancipation becomes a discussion in America, white people start trying to create all of these tropes of happy Black people. They make cartoons and they make songs and, you know, stage plays and all these things, you know, to try to promote this idea that Black people are happy and contented, even though we didn't have rights. And I didn't recognize that that's what he was doing. So when he finishes, okay, let's rewind back to 2013. When he finished his statement, because what he said was, were they happy? They were godly. That's what he said, right? So he doesn't answer if they were happy. He replies, but they were godly. And basically what he's saying is that because these people did not have, because he could not discern a Black consciousness where Black people were aware of their oppression and upset with it and ready to fight against it, he calls them godly. Right. In other words, he's saying that they're well behaved. Right. He's saying that they are good Negroes, you know, basically. I couldn't see that before because I didn't know all of those layers. I couldn't discern the historical, you know, anti-Black sentiment and propaganda, the white fascist propaganda that he was participating in. And so I wrote this blog on Tumblr years ago, you know, in 2013, where I said exactly what I told you. Maybe this man really didn't see any angry black people back then. But now I know that white people, you know, all over the world want to convince themselves that black people, not only that black people are not upset, but that black people don't have anything to be upset about.
Right. That's the more important part, right? That black people don't have anything upset or anything to be upset about. And, you know, for your story, the way that you share it, the way that I read it in the book, you talk about that anger quite openly. And I don't know. Can I ask you? I don't know that you put it so much in the book, but I'm just going to kind of ask you to ad lib here to talk about this, because you talk about your anger in the book and how anger is an important emotion to move toward activism, to move toward, you know, this nonviolent militantism. But then there's also the crappy side of that coin, which is that a lot of times black people who do show anger, right? So it's instead of being the cartoon where everybody that is black is happy because there's nothing wrong here, then when you black people do get upset, when you do get upset and you do get angry and you show your frustration, then you get dismissed because you're just the angry black man or the angry black woman in the room or in the space, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you talk about dynamics a bit?
And you have to decide, you know, what battles you're going to fight, you know, because when you're alone, if you're alone and you're in office and, you know, somebody says something racist or them doing something that's insensitive or something like that, then you have to weigh the cost to you personally to show that anger, right? But that anger is valid. It's always valid, right? But as a collective, you know, sometimes our rage is on display in protests, in riots, in those kind of things. You know, when we see the racial violence that continues to structure American society, right? And that kind of anger, I think that we just have to decide that it doesn't matter how people feel about that, you know, especially if they're not on our side, if they're not fighting with us, because, you know, Can you imagine if, you know, the American colonizers that throw the tea into Boston Harbor, can you imagine if they worried about if the British are gonna be upset with them if they throw this tea in the harbor? Can you imagine if they're asking a question, well, we don't know if we want to do that because, you know, it may look bad on us.
Right.
They may think poorly of we if we throw the tea into the harbor. No, they're not asking that question because their concern is to get free. Mm. And they don't care how their oppressor feels. they feel that Britain was their oppressor. They don't care how their oppressor feels about how they go about winning their freedom, because it's not a discussion. We are going to be free, and we are going to do what we need to do to liberate ourselves, and we're not asking for your opinion on what tactics and strategies we should use. How stupid would that be?
Right.
A lion catches a mouse, and the mouse say to the lion, wait, excuse me, Miss Assar, you can't tell me which way to go about getting me freedom. No, that's not how things work, you know? And so, of course, we're upset. We should be upset. That's what happens in the body when something infuriating happens to you. When somebody mistreats you, you are upset about that usually. If not, then usually we have names for things like that, like Stockholm syndrome. Mm. It means something is not right. Right. So, of course, we're upset. And so what we have to do, I think, as a collective is not worry so much about, you know, what the person who is invested in your oppression thinks about your quest for liberation.
and all of that. Amen. And I'm intrigued by how purposeful you were in trying to engage in a really loving level, on a really loving level, when it was personal, when it was interpersonal, right? There is a collective movement like you're talking about, where the anger is showcased and it should be. And I'm not saying anger should never be showcased on the personal level, right? But you talk about all these interactions with good friends from seminary or from other parts of your life, from growing up, right? And you express anger and they push back and then you call them on the phone.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this. We're friends.
Yeah, exactly.
We love each other.
Exactly.
Let's talk about that. Can you, I would say as a student, the one that comes to my mind, I mean, besides feeling just like really saddened about your relationship with the Stone family, which I still am just like feel really heartbroken about. One of these is kind of, it strikes me because I'm also a seminary student. This took place at not just a seminary, it took place at my seminary, but where, you know, but this is kind of the thing, right? A lot of times these quips happen where somebody feels really strongly about a certain thing, a doctrine or something else. And they just kind of whip it out there. Right. And expect that to be mic drop, last word, you know, whatever. And then you come back and say, let's talk about this. So, I mean, do you mind sharing part of that story from the book where one of your seminary friends pushes back against you in that space?
Yes. So this was after Philando Castile, after we watched Philando Castile bleed to death on Facebook Live. And, you know, that's when I started carrying the boulder around, you know, to show the weight of anti-Black racism on the Black psyche, on the mind, you know. Because these things are stressful, you know, just psychologically, it's stressful to live in a world that's constantly signaling to you that, you know, they don't respect you. Your dignity as a human being is in question, you know. And so I'm lugging this boulder. I'm one of my good friends at Fuller, you know, he overheard a conversation I was having with a professor about what happened to Philando Castile. And me and the professor are talking about how, you know, events like that, these lynchings are connected to a whole history of violence against Black people. And my friend interrupts and he, you know, because we're talking about how Philando Castile's death is part of the afterlife of slavery, of enslavement. And this friend, he interrupts and he, you know, he wants to defend slavery for some reason. I don't know why. I don't know why he wants to create some kind of nuance in a conversation that he wasn't even invited into. But, you know, he takes his friendship with me as license to come in and interrupt and to talk about, you know, how, you know, slavery might have been a positive experience for some people and he can't categorically mark it as wrong. And I'm just so surprised. And so, you know, we just end the conversation and go away. But I tried to call, I reach out to him later and I tell him that, you know, I felt betrayed by what he said. And he couldn't step back and say, wow, you know, I never thought about the fact that if I'm sitting here saying that I can't say that slavery is categorically wrong, then I'm saying that Andre, it might be okay for Andre to be enslaved, my friend. He couldn't put that together. And he was not really apologetic about it either. So, you know, we talked about getting together and talking about it a couple of times, but I decided against it because up to then I had been doing that. I had been, you know, when somebody, you know, says something that insensitive, that, you know, that stupid, that racist, you know, and we have a hard time coming together and talking about it. I would just, you know, say, well, first off, let's get off of Facebook. Let's get off of text message. Let's get off of social media and talk because we know each other. I have your number and you have my number. Why are we going back and forth online like strangers, you know, and you're responding to me like a troll, like you don't know me, right? And that's what I used to do. And I was tired of doing that by then. And also I realized because of a Heineken commercial, which I talk about in the book, you know, that That person actually doesn't deserve the platform or the time from me to say racist things to me. If they need to work out their racism, then they can read books, they can study, they can watch, you know, YouTube and talks and all those things. And I'm not saying that everything on the internet is trustworthy, we know that, you know, but they can go on their own journey of to learn some things, and then they can join conversations as informed people, as people who are wrestling with these things, and they can have those things all ironed out. But if I had had dinner with that man, he would have just sit down and tried to tell me his perspective, right? He's not trying to learn anything or listen. And so I just, you know, I let it go. But yes, oftentimes I would arrange, you know, let's get on video chat or actually talk on the phone, or, you know, let's sit down and talk, you know. But I did that until I was tired, right? I realized I was exhausted. And I also realized that my attempts to avoid the angry black man trope was just making it easier for people to, you know, to walk away from the conversation, honestly, you know, because they're just engaged in a conversation like, well, you have an opinion and I have an opinion. No, sometimes things are, you are wrong or right. Sometimes that's how it is. You don't have an opinion about what 2 + 2 equals. Either you know the sum or you don't. Right? So right. You can't tell me 6 + 3 = 7 and I tell you 6 + 3 = 9. And we say, all right, we'll agree to disagree.
But I think this is what strikes me, is that example in the book with your seminary friend is just a microcosm of what is happening in a lot of the white church, right? Like he tries, you know, in the book, you go into it a little bit further where he's, you know, talking about theology and going back to scripture, and he's, you know, kind of pulling out these things, and when in reality it really is just as you said, that's wrong. You're wrong on this.
Yes,
you're
exactly.
Wrong. You're wrong. Exactly. And sometimes that's just too much for any of us to say, is I'm wrong on this. You know, help me learn. I'm wrong on this. My husband has a ridiculous movie quote that I'm always like, this is so you. It's from Megamind. Have you seen this? It's a terrible, ridiculous movie that my family loves.
No, it's a great movie. I love that movie.
My family loves it. But there's a line where he says something like, okay, fine. You were right, and I was slightly less right. But this is not a slightly less right situation. This is I was wrong situation, but sometimes it's just too much for us to do. I want to pivot a little bit, if it's okay, because there is a concept in your book that I have to say, it's definitely possible that I have just not been paying enough attention, but, or maybe it's just the way that you phrased it really struck me. But you talk about this connection of whiteness and racism to consumerism. And you use a couple of examples. One is the dinner with the Stones. Again, I'm just, I'm so sorry. Dinner with the Stones, and then Mike Pence at Hamilton.
Oh, yeah.
And honest to goodness, I wasn't on Twitter back then, so thankfully I missed a lot of the ex-president's tweets prior to 2020, and I definitely had missed that one. But can you talk a little bit more deeply about this connection of whiteness and racism and consumerism that you go through in the book?
Yes, now that was one of the hardest chapters to write, because a lot of people don't make this connection, right? And I'm trying to make it from the beginning, like from the intro, when I say that people say that racial violence, they love to say that it's senseless, you know, but it's not senseless. It always has had a utility to it, right? And some kind of, and maybe layers of utility to it. And so one of those utilities has been profit. Right, it's been connected. Like you can't talk about how Britain and France and these places that are so quote unquote developed in the world, right? Can't talk about how they became so developed without talking about the use of slave labor to build their industries, their profit, their economies, all that stuff, right? And it's still, that system still has that logic in it, you know, to today, all till today, as they say in Jamaica, right? All to today, that system still has that kind of, you know, spirit, if you could say it that way, right? And so what we're talking about in that chapter is what one scholar, and his name escapes me a little right now, Gorski, he talks about macroaggressions, and that is where we're kind of participating in large systems of oppression, but you know, without an awareness of the violence that helps to produce those commodities that we are enjoying, right? So when you look down the supply chain of where your tomatoes are, your gold chain, or the cobalt that goes into your iPhone or computer comes from, oftentimes you're going to find people of color being abused or exploited to create those commodities, right? Now, it's not only white people that are complicit in that system, but that system goes all the way back to the construction of a global capitalist system. And racial violence is endemic to that system because part of the founding of that system was genocide of native people so that they could take the land to produce the commodities that they will sell, and then to capture African people, deport them, you know, exile them around the empire to do the labor of creating those commodities so that the price of the labor was as cheap as possible, right? Free. For the most part. Largely free, right? Okay, so I basically just take the lunch with the stones and put it in a time machine. because what happened at the table was, when I arrived at lunch that day with the stones, they announced that there would be no talking about politics because the last year, it was a few months ago, because it was Thanksgiving that something happened with me and one of the stones, and it was, you know, y'all can read about it in the book. But anyway, I come to lunch and they don't want another blow up. So they say, all right, we're not talking about politics. So they want to ignore the racial violence that pervades, permeates, structures, upholds their world while they enjoy these commodities. Some of those commodities are literally brought to the table by racial injustice and oppressive politics, because we all know what class of people and what they tend to look like who are running the kitchens in most of these restaurants, right? And we know that oftentimes that when you go even further down the supply chain, that if you go from the restaurant to the tomato field, wherever that might be, there are probably people working much longer hours than would if they were of another class, and getting paid much less than they would if they were of another class, right? Okay. That same kind of thing was happening in the 18th century here, when, because of enslavement, you know, Southerners were getting rich, plantation owners were getting rich, and now they had more disposable income, and they start wanting, you know, luxury goods like books and coffee and tea and indigo and all these things. And at the same time, while these, that was when this kind of genteel culture starts to arise in the South, because they have so much excess money. Meanwhile, the people who are producing this wealth, they don't have anything. That's us, the enslaved, right? And in order to keep the enslaved as the free work labor force, you know, they were putting down slave rebellions, because of course we were not content to be enslaved. Apparently, we still have to announce that we were not happy being enslaved. Right. And so, of course, we did what anyone would do. We rise up against it. Right. This is where Nat Turner's rebellion and all those things come in. Now, you see this juxtaposition. There are people comfortably eating and enjoying their luxury goods that are produced by the, you know, content warning. I'm sorry, but, you know, the abuse, the whipping, enslaved, the breaking of teeth, the breaking of bodies, the raping of women, all these kinds of things on a regular basis, are producing the wealth that provides this comfortable lifestyle for these people. And there is literally a culture of violence, of gun violence, by the way, right, to keep these people down. In fact, there was a law that was passed around that time that required... that required white men to carry their guns to church on Sunday, because they understood that while these plantation owners and stuff were at church, that there was that the immediate control over the enslaved population was loosened, because the overseers and all these people are observing their religious rites. And so the law required white men to carry their guns to church in case the enslaved tried to rise up on a Sunday, that they would be prepared to put down rebellions. So I'm making that connection between oppression and profit and the violence that holds that arrangement in place, to say that now, when somebody like Mike Pence goes to see Hamilton, and he is confronted by the cast who says, we are concerned about the violence happening at the southern border, that when Mike Pence says, I shouldn't have to be confronted with the violence that structures this society, because I have come here to enjoy this commodity without having to think about that violence, that he is invoking the same arrangement. He's saying, I am entitled to the same privileges that my predecessors had, where they could just enjoy this comfortable imperial life without thinking about the violence that the empire engages in every day.
And then one of the lovely gaslighting pieces of that is that you gave a content warning because of the actual abuse that was happening to enslaved peoples. And then the former president tweets and calls a really cordial letter, actually, I thought, from the cast to the vice president at the time. The former president calls that abuse.
Right.
That he shouldn't have to be, his VP shouldn't have to be subjected to abuse when he goes to the theater. That's not okay.
Right.
Come on.
Right. He said that, you know, they attacked a good man.
Right.
You know? And what? I'm like, well, he wasn't attacked, first off. Right. You know, they said, dear sir, we're concerned. Right. We're concerned about these things, and we hope you'll do something about it. And otherwise, they don't have access to the vice president. They have their chance, right? They have to take the chance that they have.
Right. Reading it from the stage,
but that's a part of living in this society, and that's why I didn't realize that the book would be so relevant, because, you know, I just wasn't sure that we would be here where we are now, you know, where we are now. And, you know, Trump is not out of the question to come back into the Oval Office. People are, you know, going into stores and shooting up the place and, you know, stabbing people upon the street and all these things, you know. And this is a part of, you know, kind of what fascism looks like, you know. And I didn't know how relevant this would be to this moment in time. But that's a part of it, is this mythical, you know, understanding of who we are and where we come from and how we got to this place. It's complete unreality.
Right. It's the unreality. And I think this is kind of, you know, I feel like Captain Obvious here, but the unreality, we're not willing to state the facts about our past. So we can't state the facts about the future, right? Going back to your example of 6 + 3 = 7, it's kind of like there are a large group of people who are saying, yeah, of course that equals 7. Because when we see the fascist stuff happening now, we mm-hmm. haven't ever confronted any of that in our past. And so it feels right to some people and normal, or, you know, whatever it is. I'll never forget, like, there's this like little, very, very specific example of that. Right after the insurrection on January 6th of last year, I remember seeing a meme of a chick probably my age, and she's like in like a student's desk, right? And she's like pointing her finger, you know, and it's like me in 20 years trying to say what actually happened on January 6th, right? Because it was a protest, everybody. It was right. Tourists inside the Capitol. It was, you know, whatever right. It is. But it's like, well, we can't even name that and say what it really is, because we haven't been able to confront all of this other truth about our history. And in fact, it's being banned from schools right, exactly. right now.
Exactly. We're living through a new kind of lost cause kind of era.
Right.
You know, we had this big, big lie about, you know, what happened with the election and the insurrection and all these things. And that's exactly what I'm trying to confront in the book, because when we believe these things, you know, we don't fight for change.
Right.
You know, when we internalize these lies, we don't fight for change. And that is kind of the fog that I was living under for a long time, because I believed what America says about itself. America is always innocent and always a paragon of democracy, and there's no need for revolution here again. You know, that's what America wants, you know, or the official story has been about America for a long time. But that story serves a few people. It doesn't serve everybody. You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There was one, I can't remember. I didn't dog ear it, but there was a place I underlined it. I hollered to my husband who was in the kitchen. I go, well, Andre just says it in this book. And, you know, I'm laughing. I'm like, well, he says it in a lot of places, but there's one place where you say something to the effect of, the only thing America has been exceptional at is being exceptionally racist, or, you know, like something yeah. like that. Right. Yeah. And I'm like, something well, like let's just yeah. say it though. Right.
Yeah. 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 I don't remember exactly how I worded it, but that is a part of the, you know, that's a part of the point that I make in the Revolution Now chapter, is that, you know, America has a fundamental problem, you know, and it wants to claim the thing about America's narrative is that it wants to claim the work that movements have done as part of its political tradition, right? And it's like, but wait, you can't claim that. All right, for instance, you can't claim the civil rights movement, right? If we had to pick that fight with you just to get the whites only signs to come down, you can't say, look how good we are, you know? And then right after you do that, you know, almost immediately, right? You still have schools all over the country where after the act was passed that said desegregation, right? You have all these Christian schools start to be built, quote unquote, Christian schools start getting built, because this is how white people are going to circumvent that now, because now we have a private school and Christian means whites only. It's the new whites only, right? After the decision was passed, still see how the civil rights movement was still fighting to desegregate spaces even after the law was passed. And then in 2013, I think it was, they gut that decision of its teeth. You know, they defanged the Civil Rights Act. And so we're constantly fighting. Right now we're fighting for voting rights again. You know, fighting against voter suppression and all those things. So America doesn't get to claim that as part of its tradition, if it's always been us fighting to have it and it's still not secure. You know, the day that America starts taking the initiative and, you know, saying, all right, what do we have to do? What do we have to do to make some kind of reparation for this?
This is one of the reasons why I love following Bernice King on Twitter, because she, I wish she didn't have to, but she's constantly calling that out, right? And you called it out very specifically in your book, because you're exactly right. Like, America claims, I just love the way you said that, but they want to claim what's come from all of these movements, even though it was fights that were picked with them. And it's like, And so you specifically talk about MLK and go, this guy was a totally polarizing figure. He was really hated. Obviously, he was assassinated, right? He did not have a good approval rating among many Americans in his time. But at the same time, people will use his own quotes to defend their racist agendas today.
Right. And that's the thing. That is exactly the thing. America can't claim, you know, all of the work that movements have done to create space for marginalized people and oppressed people as evidence that we are the leader of the free world. If we're the leader of the free world, why do we have so much protest for human rights?
Good night.
Why are there so many movements against oppression in this country if we are as democratic as we say? We are not. We are not and never have been. So we have to look the fact in the face that the idea of America did not include many people when it was invented. And people can say, well, it's changed now, but how did it come to change? How did it come to change? And has it changed enough? And who are you to say that, right? Because there were people before, there were people during the civil rights movement that probably said, well, they're not slaves anymore. What are they complaining about? You know? And after they desegregated the buses and all those things, people were saying, haven't you come far enough? Then you've come far enough, you know? And they're still saying that today.
But you're right in that this is how America was birthed. This is how all of these documents. My favorite Mark Charles quote is when he's like, you act surprised by this, you know, fill in the blank, whatever it is. You act surprised by this, but you shouldn't be surprised because the Constitution is working, right? When you see these kinds of injustices as an American, you shouldn't be shocked by what you're seeing, because the Constitution is working. The Constitution was intended to give white landowning men the ruling hand on everything. So when you see injustices and oppression toward people of color, toward women, toward, you know, people who are in poverty, you shouldn't be shocked by that, because the Constitution is doing exactly what it was designed to do.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I want to give you the last word here, Andre, because this book is so rich, but it's because your story is so rich. And so I appreciate you sharing it with me today, but also just with the readers of this. And I know that one of these major threads throughout the book is as we've been talking about this just now, this movement, right? The nonviolent movements that really have taken America to be from what we were to what we are now, and hopefully moving into the future into much better places. So what would you, what would you leave us with in that vein of the movement, the nonviolent movement being an active thing in our lives as we begin to learn more and come out of this fog, as you say?
Yeah. I mean, you know, the point of the book really is to help people to understand that we have been given a lot of ideas about how change happens and how racial progress can be achieved that just won't work, you know. And a part of my, you know, breaking up with, you know, these relationships in the book and, you know, leaving some of the institutions that I used to find nourishing, you know, is me coming to that realization that a lot of what we are told is really stuff to keep us from doing the work that will actually create change. So part of that is, you know, a lot of what we talk about today, the American ideology, you know, the Pax Americanus, you know, that says, you know, this is, you know, this is the leader of the free world, the paragon of democracy. We don't need revolution here, all those things. That is to keep us in place, and we have to wake up from that. But then after that, there, well, part of that idea. So every theory of change is based on, you know, assumptions about the way that the society is arranged and what is possible politically and all those things. And so what comes along with people who believe Pax Americanus comes the deficient ideas about change. Because we are the leader of the free world, because there's no need for revolution here, we can solve racial justice by just having some civil conversation with people who have some bad ideas, right? Well, I'm trying to tell people that no, it's actually not that way. America, there's a reason why a Nazi scholar said that the greatest event in the Aryan quest for world domination was the creation of the United States of America. There's a reason why they wrote that. And there's a reason why Langston Hughes, you know, went to one of those international writing conferences and tell them, we don't need anyone to explain what fascism is to us, because we know already. We know already through experience, our experience of living in America. So we have to start there. There has always been something wrong, something oppressive, something unequal in America's political tradition. Right. That's always been there. But it doesn't have to be that way going forward, because we have already seen the power of people who recognize the problem and organize together to address it. You know, we've already seen that power in American history, but in histories all over the world through civil resistance. But we're not going to be able to get there if we don't first off break free of the spell of American ideology, right? The Pax Americanus. And we also won't be able to build those kinds of movements if we keep on arguing with people who want to debate whether or not the problem exists. And that's partly why I tell these stories about the people that I had to leave behind, because in order for me to join the movement, you know, I had to leave that conversation behind and everyone who wanted to keep having it, you know, because it's like, I think I've used this example before, but suppose you're a doctor and you're in the operation room and you're a surgeon and you're about to start working. And there's somebody in the room who doesn't understand surgery. And they said, boy, if you cut that man, he's going to die. And you say, no, actually, if I don't cut this man, he's going to die, you know. If you go back and forth with this man who doesn't understand surgery, what's going to happen to your patient? Mm. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You see? So we have to move beyond that. And when we move beyond that, then we can start understanding the wisdom of so many people who have actually worked to change the world before, which I've tried to compile as much information as I can in one book for people who probably would never come across this information otherwise.
Yeah, Andre, thank you. Thank you so much for that. I feel like I just want to say, like, we didn't even get to some of the stuff in the book that is kind of most jarring, most phenomenal, right? I mean, the Boulder story, I'll just going to throw this out there. The Boulder story in and of itself is worth the price of the book. So grab the book and read about it. But thank you so much, Andre, for joining me, for coming on, for writing this, for your work, for your movement in this space, in this movement, building place. I'm really grateful, for you and for your, gosh, all of your time and talents dedicated to this work. I appreciate you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.